the Bobo. Journalist David Brooks coined the word to describe what he calls bourgeois bohemians. His book, Bobos in Paradise, traces the rise of this new upper class. Steve Paulson wants to know who these people are.
How do you recognize a Bobo when you see one on the street or at home?
Well, if you walk into their house and they've got one of those renovated kitchens that's the size of an aircraft hangar with plumbing, with, you know, those super huge ranges that send up heat like a space shuttle rocket turned upside down, then it's a pretty good indication that you're in Bobo land. They've got these fridges that look like minivans stood on end, like one side is for the refrigerator and the other side could be an in-law suite. These things are so big.
So where did you ever come up with the concept of the Bobo, the bourgeois bohemian?
Basically, what we're talking about here are people who live in upscale America. And this whole book really started because I lived in Europe for the first half of the 1990s, and I came back and saw an American culture that seemed to me transformed by the information age. What had happened is the old categories didn't make sense anymore. It used to be easy to tell the bourgeoisie, who were the straight, boring ones who lived in suburbs and worked in corporations. It used to be easy to tell them from the bohemians who lived downtown and were arty and creative. The bourgeois worked in corporations. They were commercial. And the bohemians were sort of rebels and artists. But when I got back, it seemed like everything was all mixed up. You had in bohemian downtown neighborhoods, you had these $4 million lofts with people eating fancy lettuces, you know, the kind that taste so bad on sandwiches. And then you had the bourgeois suburbs where everyone was pretending they were artists and intellectuals. And, you know, you had bankers wearing those tiny steel-rimmed eyeglasses to make themselves look like Franz Kafka.
Well, give me a little bit more of a sense of the consuming behavior of Bobos. What are some of the things they like to buy?
Well, one of the things, if you're a Bobo, is you have a code of financial correctness, which means that you want to prove, no matter how much you spend, that you don't really care about material things and consumption, because you're much too spiritual for that. So, for example, they have a distinction between wants and needs. It's vulgar to spend on a luxury, but if something's practical, then you can spend as much as you want. So, for example, it's vulgar to spend $40,000 on a media center with a big screen TV. But if you spend $20,000 on a Slate shower stall, that just proves you're, you know, at one with the zen-like rhythms of nature. It would be vulgar to spend $60,000 on a Corvette. But to spend on a practical Range Rover that much money, that just shows, you know, you're thinking with your head. And I have in the book all these rules of financial correctness. For example, you can never have too much texture. You know, old elites, the old WASP elite, liked polished, smooth things. So now to prove that you're no snob, you should have weathered slates, all these textured stuff, woven rugs, obscure wild grasses, bumpy sweaters. Your furniture should be distressed and beaten, because if your furniture is distressed, your conscience doesn't need to be.
Well, you point out that the New York Times wedding page is a showcase for Bobos. What do you notice when you look at these pages?
Yeah, that wedding page, if you want to be an aspiring Balzac and write about upscale America, that page is beautiful. Because in the 50s, it talked about your connections, when your people came over from the Mayflower. It talked about what debutante ball you came out at if you were a bride, and if you were a groom, what club you belonged to. It really was the Protestant establishment brought to life. Now, if you look at the New York Times wedding page, it's like a clash of resumes. It's Harvard marries Stanford, Rhodes marries Fulbright. And my favorite part about it is they have something called the vows column, which is a column where they describe one particular wedding in great detail. And the message of the column is always the same, that these people may be making $1 million a year and working 80 hours a week, but don't think they're really ambition or they're consumed by ambition. They're just free spirit rebels upon whom this success happened to fall like chance out of the sky. And they give these little histories of the relationship. So the couple always met like while they were recovering from a marathon or out digging for Pleistocene Man. But then they always broke up because they needed their personal space. One went off to, you know, arrange the largest merger in Wall Street history, and the other settled for neurosurgery after dropping out of sommelier school or something. But then they always get back together, and they have these wacky weddings to show how unpretentious they are. You know, they'll hire the band Devo to play the Jeopardy theme song at the wedding. So that page really traces the decline of one establishment, the Protestant establishment, and the rise of a new one, an establishment based on education and based on this Bobo culture.
So how did this happen? The bourgeoisie were the people bohemians hated. The bourgeoisie were the ones with the stifling moralistic values. They didn't have an artistic bone in their body, and they sneered at the eggheads. How did these two cultures come together?
Well, I think it really is a product of the information age. You know, in the industrial age, if you made money and you were in trucking or something, or mining or extraction, that really was different from being an artist. And as you say, there's been a culture war, at least since the 1830s, when Bohemians really came into being in Paris, between these two groups. And it was so vivid in the early part of this century that you had the Horatio Alger bourgeois types and the Bohemians who lived in Greenwich Village and celebrated, you know, sexual freedom and all that kind of stuff. You know, even in our own politics in our own day, you had Republicans mostly who loved the 80s and hated the 60s, and Democrats mostly who loved the 60s and hated the 80s. But one thing we know about the information age economy, it rains money on people with education. And if you've got the education, suddenly you're making more money than you ever thought. And some people say, well, these Bobos are just 60s radicals or 90s radicals who've sold out. But I don't think that's quite fair, because they really have changed the institutions they have come to inhabit. Bill Clinton really has changed, and he's a perfect example, the way politics is done. And everyone post-Clinton will really be practicing a politics which is very hard to define in old culture war terms.
How would you describe that? What's different in the Clinton age of politics than what happened before?
Well, one of the things Clinton has done is he embraces cultural conservative ideas, like he's for school uniforms, and also cultural liberal ideas. He's for, you know, condoms in school. And that happens again and again and again. He's for something on column A, something in column B. They call it triangulation, but it's really a mush. It's a reconciliation of different ideas. And sometimes it doesn't make sense. But one of the things it's done, it's de-ideologized our politics. George W. Bush, you see, doing the exact same thing. Sometimes he seems very liberal in his spending policies he's been announcing, sometimes very conservative at Bob Jones University. People thought when this educated group came to power, we would have a very ideological left-right war in politics. But in fact, the exact opposite. We have this ideological muddle, and it makes it very hard for people on left and right.
You mentioned that Bobo behavior extends into a lot of different areas of life, and I would guess one of those would be our spiritual lives, and I suppose a lot of what goes for New Age spirituality would be quintessential Bobo activity.
Yeah, though halfway, I'd say. You know, I talked about the culture war. On the traditional side, on the bourgeois side, you had a very strict idea of religion, which was traditionalist. You obey the word of God. You don't say, what's good for me? You say, what does God command and obey? So you defer to authority. And then we had this Bohemian revolt, which really started 200 years ago, but was most prominent in the 60s, where it's a much more identified individual religion. What's good for me? I'm going to try this New Age thing, that New Age thing. I'm going to have a personal God that just is about me and what fulfills me. But the problem with that individualized religion was it's great for exploration and self-exploration, but it precludes the possibility of arriving anywhere. So people found it unsatisfying and also very hard to hand down to your kids because it's not organized, it's not institutionalized. So what you have now in the Bobo world is this mixture of the traditional orthodoxy and the New Agey. And while I was doing the research for this book, I came across a rabbi in Montana who used the word flexidoxy. And that struck me as a perfect word, this attempt to combine flexibility and freedom, the sort of individual freedom we saw flowering in the 60s, with sort of roots, with a way to tie down your spiritual faith to things that are beyond and deeper than individual choice. Now, I don't know if it can work, and in the book I really raise serious doubts about whether you can build this cathedral of obligation on a foundation of choice. But it's worth a try, maybe.
You know, we may laugh at these Bobos, these bourgeois Bohemians, but I have to tell you, I recognize myself in some of your descriptions. I don't have an SUV or a Slate shower stall, but I do like gourmet coffee, and I buy those good educational toys for my kids. I eat Ben and Jerry's ice cream, and I guess I have to ask, is there anything wrong with being a Bobo?
No, I'm one myself. I consider myself a Bobo with bad grades. Because, you know, one of the things that this class is really built on is education. You know, it used to be you got ahead if you were part of the right, you know, family or you were part of the right military organization. But now it's education. And I didn't study hard enough to be one of these hypercharged Bobos on the New York Times wedding page. But, you know, education has, you know, allowed me and many of us to get to pretty interesting jobs where we enjoy ourselves. And on the surface, you know, I grew up, or at least went to high school in a suburb outside of Philadelphia, which I talk about in the book. It was so boring when I grew up there. There was nothing, no interesting stores, and really not that much culture. Now it's become, you know, there are 6 gourmet coffee shops. There's a fantastic independent bookstore. One of the coffee shops is called Cafe Procopio, and it says on the side of the cup, you know, there are always texts in these sorts of stores. It says, Café Procopio was named after a 17th century Parisian café where artists, radicals, and revolutionaries gathered to talk. And in Wayne, this town where I grew up, there aren't any artists, radicals, and revolutionaries, but there are a lot of people who want to drink coffee like one. And that's made Wayne more interesting, just much more exciting. I think it's been great for the business world, too. But I have doubts about the spiritual world, what it's done. I think sometimes we Bobos are too easy on ourselves. And also politics. I think it's made our politics tepid and boring and mushy. And I wonder if we can really embrace change. In some ways, the Bobos, though many would consider themselves liberal, are conservative in ways, not conservative in the Newt Gingrich way, but conservative in distrusting large change. Conservative meaning preserving. They're very interested in preserving the status quo, not very utopian or not very ambitious about change, political change for the future. So I think religiously and politically, I think there are problems. But as far as consumer life, as far as business life, and even intellectual life, I think things are pretty darn good right now.
David Brooks, talking with Steve Paulson. Brooks is a senior editor at The Weekly Standard and the author of Bobos in Paradise.